Welcome to episode 34 of the Payments Show podcast. My name is Satwant Phul, and today I'll be speaking to Andrew Jamieson, who is the co-founder and CEO of Extend. Extend is a virtual card platform which enables businesses to create, send, and manage virtual cards for all business payments and simplify expense processes. Enjoy the episode. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show. Much appreciated.
I've really been looking forward to this episode. One of the most popular episodes I've had was one of the earlier ones with Westpac Bank in Australia, when I talked to Haroon, one of their product managers, around their instant digital card for consumers. And I've been looking to get somebody on who is offering virtual card solutions to talk about it in more detail. So when your team called, I thought this is fantastic and really wanted to get you on as quickly as possible. So thank you.
No, it's great. It's great to be on the show to be able to talk about it. It's obviously an emerging technology. And I think what's interesting here is it's going to continue to evolve really fast from this point onwards.
That sounds great. I'll give you a quick introduction. So Andrew Jamieson is the co-founder and CEO of Extend, which is based in New York. And you are in New York as well, I believe, right now. No, you're in Florida. Sorry.
For now.
For now. Yeah. And Extend allows businesses to instantly create secure virtual cards for employees, projects, and vendors at a very high level. But I'm sure I'm not doing it justice. We'll get into detail throughout the episode. But you've also worked for many years, I think around 10 or 11 years at American Express, and you've worked in B2B corporate payments and many other roles as well. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of insights which you'll be able to add from there as well. So really excited to be getting into that with you. Now, I'm going to start the show a bit unconventionally. I'll use it as a partial therapy session as to when I was issued with a corporate card in my first ever job. So my first ever job was at Hewlett Packard back in the UK. And even back then, it was pretty frustrating to use it. So I had this Amex corporate card. First of all, I had to apply for it. So it wasn't really that convenient to have it. Then I still had to submit receipts and expense reports. So it didn't save me any time. There was no categorization of the expenses. If I lost a receipt, the expense would normally be rejected, so it didn't give me any advantages there. And not everywhere accepted Amex, so it wasn't that great anyway. I had to use my own credit card a lot of the time. And if you lose it or have any other kind of issues, just like you do with a normal card, the whole thing was just not that great as a employee. So I wanted to just get that out there because I thought as a former Amex employee, you'd appreciate that. But on a more serious note, there's a lot of problems that your solution solves. And, you know, I could talk about this for hours and hours, to be honest. But I want to hand it over to you let's set the scene as to what Extend is all about, what the solution's about, and why the company was founded and why you started it.
Yeah, no, look, I can draw a parallel to your story, right? Which is, you know, I started off in consulting, always around payments. I had the option of joining a strategic consulting company, one of the top three. And it was really about sort of getting that strategic experience. My father laughed and said, what on earth are you going to provide strategy to like these established companies about? You've literally no experience. So instead, I went into sort of more of a startup focused on actually deploying SAP for companies. And the company grew really fast, right? I was employee number 52. You know, wind the clock forwards 5 years. Organically, we were 700 people. But part of being a consultant was travel. Right. So exactly to your point, we weren't given a corporate card. So instead, I was traveling around, putting essentially all of my expenses and my personal and business on the one Barclay card I had at the time. And so then I stopped traveling about 3.5 years later. And where I had assumed I was owed about £3,500, I actually realized I actually wasn't. So I was in a hole for £4,000 and realized that actually the best way for me to pay it off is actually to take out debt in order to then structure it in a more effective way. So that's the converse story, right, of not having a corporate card, and to some extent forms a part of the path of Extend, which is, why should any employee ever be fronting cash for their company? At the end of the day, totally doing agree. This travel on behalf of the company, any employee that's asked to spend should be doing it on a company's dime. And so that's a little bit at the genesis of how we think about payments in this certainly in the corporate space, and I can talk more about the consumer space going forwards. But it's around how do you provide access. And earlier on, you talked about how in Australia with Westpac, they talked about digitizing the process, right? And it's true. Most of the I'd say high street banks or main street banks today have gone digital on the application side of things, right? So you can apply and you can get a credit card right here, right now, and off you go. The challenge you then have, though, is twofold. One is you have to wait for the physical plastic. And then the other part of it is that's all well and good. But if you run a business, you want to be able to empower others. And you don't necessarily want to have a card for them because you might need to empower them for a week. You might need to empower them once a month for a subscription that they have. That shouldn't require you to issue them with a card. So all of those different pieces come together to sort of say, okay, so yes, banks have solved for digital distribution. What you see is emerging players that have gone one step further, which is to say, yes, but from that account, you should be able to create an instant hierarchy of other cards that roll up to yours, but you're still in total control of them. That's where we've taken it to the next level in terms of thinking about, you know, not just digital creation, but distribution of access.
Talking on that hierarchy, from what I saw of your solution online, it looks very straightforward to set up. So for people listening and they can't kind of visualize this, it's a simple app that users can download where ultimately any virtual card that is issued to you as an employee or contractor that needs a credit card for that business, you will have it loaded into your app. It will have spending controls and limits placed on it. And I'm assuming, you know, on the other side for the business issuing those virtual cards, there'll be a very simple kind of platform where they can do that too, right?
So the big thing that's happened in this industry, and again, always led by sort of emergent fintechs, right, is the idea that you essentially need to make onboarding easy. Virtual cards, the onboarding of virtual cards has never been easy. It's a business that Amex was right at the heart of because they bought G's card portfolio. With it came this amazing virtual card engine, which we were very excited about because suddenly it was your ability to create these virtual cards and give them to merchants and lodge them in different places. The problem is the setup took essentially weeks, months. Why? Because it needed IT resources from the client. The bank had to assign a project manager. Then the person in the field had to get the client to sign a contract. So it had to go to legal. You had to renegotiate rebates. And so all in all, this technology was only made available to like enterprise clients. We're talking Fortune 1000, Fortune 500 customers, because it's just too onerous to get it up and running. So what happened in the interim is other companies emerged using sort of more modern payment stacks and essentially said, we're going to make onboarding a 5-10 minute exercise. And so that's the other thing I didn't realize that startup did. It wasn't just about rethinking how they underwrite you as a business. It's also rethinking how quickly you can get access to something. And so that helped us to evolve our thinking and strategy, which was like, we can't rely on having to have banks do this complicated setup. So how do we make it easily accessible so that any size business, because at the end of the day, a credit card is as useful to a consumer as it is to the biggest businesses, but how do I make sure that other end of the spectrum gets access to this amazing technology because it's about financial discipline and control? And that's where we changed the game and said, what if I could activate you from the very card that's already in your pocket? And so that's what we went and launched first with American Express in September, was actually you can just pull out your card, use that card to register. And of course, American Express essentially then asks you to authenticate that you meant to register your card with Extend for security reasons. But actually that process end to end takes 5 minutes. And then you immediately have access to sending out virtual cards. So we reimagined learning from people in the industry that had started with a blank sheet of paper, but recognize that we strongly believe as a company that credit cards aren't necessarily broken. They just, people want their credit cards to do more. And that's what we said is, don't go and set up a new bank account. Don't create a new relationship. Use the existing one you have. Now use that card as a springboard for offering effectively what we feel is almost like a new feature.
Yeah. You actually answered a major question that I had, which was, what are these billion-dollar companies like Amex and Visa, you know, doing? Like, surely they would have seen this coming, but you filled in the piece of the puzzle there where it was just such a pain through your GE example with Amex. So I didn't actually realize that they tried it, but made it very cumbersome.
So look, I think the interesting part for me is, and people don't realize this, right, in many cases, right, there are a lot of new emerging technology players that come out of the woodwork every day. The challenge is this, is that banks, because they're highly regulated and because we're dealing with cash, they essentially have these systems that they've spent sometimes $1 billion on orchestrating these systems so that they do underwriting and risk management to make sure that there is no fraud on your card, right? To make sure that essentially you can remit correctly and they can service you. All of these things are just tentacles that got woven into a platform that's 40 years old. And so the challenge that they have is, how do you innovate in a world where you've got all these constraints? And so, yes, all these emerging players came out and said, oh, we're going to reinvent it from scratch. The problem is 99% of the world doesn't start with a blank sheet of paper. And so what we had to reimagine more importantly was, okay, so if that's the existing construct, how do we rewire things using the existing wires that are there, but repackage them in a way that we can then launch new capabilities for these banks, right? And that's the big discipline that we went through over the last 3 to 4 years, was taking all these disparate endpoints that are 30 years old and essentially repackaging them up. Think of it almost like, instead of having to go to individual grocery stores, we said, that's fine. We're going to essentially create a solution that's tantamount to going to a Walmart, and you get everything in one place through one simple experience. And so that's what we've done for the traditional Main Street banks, is do that hard work to now enable them to innovate at pace and keep up with really client needs.
Yeah. And so, again, for people listening who may not be able to visualize it, if it's a small or a medium-sized company, not a large enterprise, if you're, say, a software company with 20 people, the MD has one business credit card, that MD can use Extend to maybe issue a $100 stationery card to one person and a $2,000 one for the sales rep for a Mac or vice versa. That's essentially what it is. Whether
that's
it's
right.
A small business, two people, maybe up to thousands, right?
That's exactly right, right? The whole idea is, you have a credit card, we've just now given you the power to do so much more with it. And importantly, is make sure you're in total control by making sure we put the right parameters on cards, making sure that you know when someone spends, you get notifications instantly you see someone spend. So my Salesforce knows that I see them getting into a car service headed to the airport to go and see a client, because I see the transactions come through real time on my phone and notifications. So I'm always, as a small business with 26 people, I know exactly what people are doing, because every time I see a transaction, it tells me on my phone. And obviously I can change the settings, but it just, again, it's the feeling of knowing that essentially helps you know that you're in control, that things aren't suddenly, you're not going to have surprises at the end of the month. Because that's the other big thing with people using their personal cards, is lo and behold, at the end of the month, people put through their expenses and you're like, hang on a second, what just happened here? Right, that transparency, that importance of being able to see forwards, is also key to small companies trying to manage their working capital, their cash flow, right? Knowing what's coming ahead.
You preempted two threads of the unexpected kind of story area that I had on my question list. So there are horror stories that we all know of employees misusing company money. I think that's a given. But I've worked with colleagues. Not only have they used their personal Visa, MasterCard in scenarios where the Amex is not accepted, but they've used their Amex cards for personal expenses. And I've seen a couple of people get in real trouble with that. So it kind of solves both problems at once, doesn't it?
Yeah, look, and it's funny. Different companies have different policies. Some companies are okay with using your corporate card for personal expenses because they'll only reimburse you for the ones where you submit the receipts, right? And other companies have a policy of absolutely not. And then there's friendly fraud, right? Mistakes that happen because you happen to have your corporate card in your Uber app and you forgot to change the profile to your personal card. I think what we're trying to control is the runaway trains, which is, hey, I have a card that has a limit of maybe $30,000, $40,000 because I'm the assistant to an MD in a company, right? And I'm busy and I'm doing all these different things. And before you know it, they're buying, you know, everyone's nightmare, right? They've set up their own wedding by using the card and pushing through the expenses, right? We've all heard those stories. I think by virtue of the fact that people can request a card for a very specific expense, you're limiting what that cap is, right? Because it'll be like, I need to go to a conference, I'm going to need $2,500. And you're going to request that as your limit. And again, as soon as the first transaction goes through, you're seeing it happen. It's a car service, it's a hotel booking, it's those things happening in real time. So your ability to lock it down really quickly is key, because you don't want to constrain it so much that no one can do anything. You just want people to know that you see everything that they see. And so you will be able to shut it down. And so I think you're here to empower people up to a certain limit. And that's really what we provide here.
Yeah, it's just setting those boundaries so that it looks after everyone, the company and the employee. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Look, if all the things, these are all legitimate business expenses, right? There's there's no harm, no foul in people knowing what expenses are going through, right? Yeah. That's the key here. And that's it, that transparency ensures that people do the right thing, right, as far as the business is concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk a bit more detail around the stakeholder side of things. So we all know that corporate cards are typically for employees of a company. That's obvious. But I really like how your company is looking at other stakeholders, widening that circle. So I've seen, after doing a bit of research, that, you know, contractors and freelancers is a big one. You know, you wouldn't issue them with a corporate Amex card anyway because they're not on payroll. Candidates, I've spent money on interviews, job interviews and things in the past where I've had to claim. And then you've also got volunteers and disaster relief. That's something that I hadn't thought of. So it seems that you've really planned for quite a few more scenarios than just let's fix corporate cards with virtual cards. You've really seemed to have looked at a much wider circle. Perhaps you want to talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, so it's not us coming up with all these ideas, right? We just have people coming to us saying, I would like to be able to use it for these scenarios. And the emergency one is a key one for businesses. We just recently had a business had to effectively get a product recall. They had to go to the store and essentially go around all the stores to pick up defective goods. So how are they going to go and get essentially 400 employees who are going to have to go around these stores and pick up all of these goods? How would you do that in an instant? And they had to do it because they had to get the products off the shelves. So in our case, it was simple, right? They registered their card and suddenly they were distributing cards into the hands of the 300-400 people that were going to go out and essentially go and withdraw the products from the shelves. So the immediacy of it and the fact that I can give it to you wherever you are, you don't have to be waiting at your desk for that card to arrive. You could be already on your way on the road and you can ask for more funds. And again, subject to the approval, gets delivered instantly to you. And then you can essentially go and make that charge. So the use cases are really broad as they go deep inside of different businesses. But again, it's clients who are helping us reimagine it, right? We have a law firm who has a lot of pass-through billings. So they incur expenses because essentially they have court filing fees and all these different things. And they essentially then need to rebill their customers. So instead of someone spending weekends reallocating charges as they come through on someone's corporate card, they're now essentially able to create a card per client. So now when the bills come in, they essentially just keep charging that client. If the case is a big client, they may have a card per project for that client. But again, it allows them to structure their business where they're automating and getting tremendous efficiencies on the back end and accelerate essentially their ability to rebuild clients and therefore, you know, get the monies back in the front door. So the idea of having something that's immediate, that's easy to distribute, that's totally controllable, just means, like a credit card in its pure form, its uses are somewhat endless in terms of how you can inject it into different life situations.
Now that you mentioned that scenario, that was excellent. I want to talk a bit more to the mechanics of it before we then zoom out a bit later and look at the more business benefits. So I want to split this part of the show up into the business user experience and the end user experience. So let's look at the business side and how it interacts with the actual place where that person's going to be spending the money. Things like refunds, chargebacks, and things like that. It just works as normal as if it was a physical card, right? Because I'm just trying to think, if it's a virtual card, you can have the scenario where you or I shut our personal cards down. We might have bought something, and after 11 months, we need a refund because it's faulty. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still within the one-year warranty, but you don't have the card. Well, is it a similar sort of painful experience if that virtual card expires, and then for whatever reason, that person needs a refund? How does that work?
Yeah, so you're right, right? These virtual cards are essentially spin-offs that eventually tie back to the actual funding account, right? The very card you have effectively in your pocket. And so when a refund happens, it's the same thing happens. It eventually just maps it back to the actual parent card. And there's some safeguards put in place in there to make sure that can happen, right? And it's to do with how quickly you reuse these digital cards. These numbers get recirculated. But again, there's rules around not recirculating these cards for a year, for 18 months, right, to make sure that essentially this whole system sits together and syncs perfectly well to do the returns, to do the refunds, to get all of these things working. So yes, that you're exactly right. If you essentially want to return something, you'll go back, they will essentially process it against that same very card, and then the funds will flow through to the main account, right, which is ultimately what you pay your bill off. is from that main account.
Yeah. And then from the shop or the merchant's perspective, if I'm standing there at Staples and I'm presented with this virtual card, again, let's dig a bit deeper into the mechanics. Does it integrate with Apple Pay or something, or how does it work in terms of the app itself?
So great question, and something we just launched actually in January of this year. We launched our first issuer, City National Bank, actually the ability for these cards to go from being just digital cards on your phone, right? Think of them almost as a picture of your card, even though it's a little bit more sophisticated than that. But think of it then of then being able to transition into your digital wallet so that you can make a contactless transaction. So that's the world that we're rapidly moving to. I'd say the US as a whole has been a huge laggard in this space, right? The contactless experiences in the US are 5-10 years behind what you're used to seeing in Asia and certainly in Europe, and even more so in Australia, right? Which is a huge contactless proponent. And so in the US, I'll say when we set up our company, so convinced was I that real virtual cards were not going to really take off until there was a ubiquity of acceptance versus a true physical piece of plastic. We even had a patent pending that said, we're going to take that virtual card and you're going to be able to walk into a store, pick up a card like you pick up a gift card, and you'll pair essentially that card on your phone to a physical card, and then you'll be able to use it like everyone else, right? And so we had a patent pending on that. We were really excited because, again, it was all about creating an ecosystem where you could then go spend anywhere. Well, that whole thing is pretty much scrapped on the shelf because COVID and the whole pandemic has changed, right, how merchants perceive the importance of contactless. And so in just these last 13 months, the US has skipped forward 5 years, in my estimation, in terms of what that ecosystem looks like. So then goes back to your point is that becomes even more important that we can then support that technology. So we've just launched it, right? We're the first to launch the idea that these digital cards can actually then make their way into your wallet. Remember, this is not your digital card. This is a fractionalization of your card into a new card. And again, mechanically, you have to remember, these actual accounts you ship to someone else aren't on the system of record as a card themselves, right? So all of the things that were designed for physical cards don't necessarily work on these digital cards. So we're the first to reimagine in collaboration with TSYS and the card networks, TSYS being the main provider of credit cards for businesses and consumers, right, in the banking world. That's a technology, right, that they use to manage their card programs. We're the first ones to launch this early in January this year, and something that we're going to continue now rolling out across all our different issuing partners.
That's great. I remember the last time I went to the States, coming from Australia, I just pulled out my phone to pay for a meal at a restaurant. And she said, well, first of all, she couldn't even bring the machine over. I had to go to the bit where they had the bar. And then I gave my card, and then they swiped it. And I can't even remember the last time anyone used a magstripe on my card. So it was truly like going back, just like you said, 5-6 years at least. Yeah.
Yeah, it's at least that much, right? I remember when chip was first enabled in America, and we're talking less than 10 years ago. Because again, I remember coming from the US back to London to go and meet with my team over there. And I had to take a train ticket to get to our serving center from Victoria down to Brighton. And of course, you go to the machine and you try and insert your card. And it's like, no, you need a chip. And you're like, but I don't have a chip. This is a valid card. And so, no, you had to go to the counter, right? You couldn't use any of the ticketing machines. So it just goes to show, right? And look, this is one thing I've really learned about really in being in the US now for, what is it, I think 17 years, is whilst the US has one currency and it has one language, right, it has 50 states. And those 50 states are tantamount to 50 countries. There's very little legislation that happens at the federal level, very little, actually. Most of it happens at the state level. And so as a result, right, things progress really, really slowly. And so there's the special interest groups sort of almost also play against it, right? So the reason why we didn't have it with oil was because the oil and gas lobby groups, so they couldn't change their pumps quick enough, right, in the US. And so, again, they had a dispensation, right, in order for them to be able to have time to change the pumps, the technologies that went with it, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, it's a different kind of beast over here. But it's an amazing place because it's still like the preeminent place for innovation, right? So you deal with this nothing is mandated, right? There's none of this PSD2, like open banking pieces of like you need to make data available to everybody. At the same time, there's this massive appetite to break down barriers and walls and innovate.
Yeah, it's strange. Like, just on a tangent, I use a VPN. I got so fed up with GDPR messages since being in the UK. I use a VPN. I set it to the US when I'm browsing the web. And I don't get pop-ups every 5 seconds on every website that I visit. It's like using the internet back in, 2000.
Yep.
It's fantastic. I just couldn't deal with it anymore. It was just driving me mad.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Staying on the user experience, again, the interaction between businesses and the end user. I just want to dig into how the controls work at one more level of depth. So let's say I allocate $100 for stationery. First of all, can that be done? Can I go and spend it in a clothes shop when I should be spending it at Staples? How does that work?
Yeah, look, it's a little bit of an art and not science, right? Because the industry operates over what's called merchant category codes, right? And so when you set up a business, right, and you essentially become a merchant, right, you're assigned a category, which sort of classifies you as a merchant. And so the way the industry works, because it would be impractical to do it merchant by merchant, because you'd actually have to know that specific merchant number. And in many cases, they may have 5 point of sale terminals in the store, right? In which case, there's 5 different numbers you'd have to manage, right? And so the reality of it is that most of it works on categories. So it says you could go into a stationery store, but you couldn't go into restaurants, right? You set essentially what's called whitelists, right? Or blacklists, one or the other, which says you can do this and only this, or you can do everything but this, right? And yep. So, yes, those controls are very much there. Again, I think the big difference here is people wanted to have those blocks in place when they had purchasing cards with really high limits. But now extending someone essentially a $50 card for them to go and buy stationery, the reality is we're not seeing people put those blocks on because, again, it's just more things you have to sort of manage. Because as soon as you use your card and suddenly you're in a restaurant, the question is, do you really want to lose your job over $50? And the answer is no. And the fact is, you know that I know what you're doing. And so you actually don't do it. It goes back to what I talked about earlier on. The transparency is way more powerful than the absolute control of saying you can only go spend there. That being said, you can absolutely do what you said. And in fact, one of the big partners, which is another side of the business that we're managing, right? They're essentially launching with a manufacturer of Invisalign, right? The teeth alignment. And there it's all about people don't necessarily want to spend $3,000 to $7,000, right? What they essentially would like to be able to do is to finance it in installments, right? And so this is where we're helping in this B2B2C world. And so the lender essentially then is able to say through an app, do you want to essentially want to finance it? And if the answer is yes, then our technology is used by that lender to essentially generate a card, send it to that individual, but it is locked, right, to the dentistry category codes. Because now essentially I've got a loan, right, and I can also make sure that if I'm a lender, I need a threshold of which I can make loans because otherwise it doesn't economically make sense. And they said anything above $500, right? And so we can also control to say, like, actually don't accept a charge that's below $500, right, that's outside of these categories. So there's a lot of really sophisticated controls to really help with different use cases, right, which are all there to sort of make sure that A, it happens where it happens, and B, when it does happen, it's super easy to reconcile that transaction came through from that dentist, but it relates back to Andrew Jamison's loan that essentially he took out on this date with these terms.
That's really good because you've got the payment data for that business as well. Then doing the underwriting for the loan again is faster and easier.
Well, so again, we don't underwrite, right? It's really but I mean, your lending businesses. Yeah, absolutely. Right, they have all of that data at their disposal, and importantly, right, we essentially can help them reconcile two disparate things. Right, one is, hey, I had to settle with that merchant anyway. Right, the dentist had to get paid right here, right now, and then there's a secondary transaction that happened, which is I need to pay back my loan. But the very fact that I see a transaction come through with a reference numbers that says it's this loan, it's this individual, it's everything else I need, them tying those two things together just became something that's second nature to the product itself. And it goes a little bit back to what I was saying about the law firm, right? Because the account number is assigned to a client number, same thing, right? The charge comes through. You don't have to think twice. You just know, okay, well, this is for client ABC and this one's for client XYZ. It's just an inherent benefit of the product to the businesses is having all of these enriched data tags that effectively says, you know, why was this spent in the first place? Going back to your point of also helping to auto allocate expenses in the back end so people aren't spending, you know, days and hours on the back end trying to figure out how they need to go and push these transactions to the right expense buckets.
Yeah. Going back to that legal example, let's say that legal person is working on, I don't know, 15 cases and she has 15 cards as an example. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the user experience and the design of the graphical interface. Is it quite clear in terms of what cards for what? If there's a mistake made, first of all, is that possible? And can you, on the back end, switch it around?
So, look, it is very clear because you name every card, right? And as you pull up a card, the name is there, you know, for that particular client, right? Or the number is there for that particular client. And the reality is, if there's a mistake made, we can't switch it on the back end, right? Because the charge happened, you essentially do what you did before, which is you put a refund through and then you recharge the other card.
Yeah.
So that process is pretty seamless, actually, from the client's experience. And by the way, the bigger it becomes, right, that's the other thing. Eventually, they want to stop using an application. They don't want to use an app. They don't want to use a web browser because they have another system through which they're managing and logging all these different things, right? And so everything we do is API driven and API first. So we actually also expose to clients and say, look, if you want to wire this up through a really simple set of APIs and people code to them in a matter of a week, right, then you might want to use that, right? Because then there's one less user experience that you have to manage as a company, and it's baked straight into your existing systems. So again, typically either when scale warrants it, and so we have a company here that essentially pays tolls on behalf of different distribution companies, trucks. And so again, there's so many of these tolls that are going through on any given day that they have to automate it, right? Because otherwise someone is going to spend a day just essentially creating these cards and settling with these different bills. And we've helped them to automate the process. This automatically link our systems. And every time a toll comes up, we generate a card and then you can punch that through and make the settlement.
Yeah, excellent. Let's focus on some of the things about the API that you just mentioned. So you mentioned the lending and integrations between those kinds of scenarios. But I, when I was doing research, I found some really interesting things like at a resort, if someone's on holiday, that the payment options that they can be presented with, not holiday, maybe they're just staying for business, sorry. I think you had a case study of a hotel. And yeah, I just want to talk about some examples where you've seen success and some customer case studies and really to sort of drive home the benefits for businesses. You've mentioned things like reconciliation on your website and improving cash flow. That seems really interesting. So do you want to talk about some of those and with the context of some actual clients that you have?
Yeah. So look, one of the big things that we help customers solve for, right? Because it's just simply a lot less travel has occurred over the last 12 months, right? Just because of COVID and the pandemic. But what we saw happen is a huge uptake on companies who small and large alike have this tailspin, this nightmare of 80% of the paper that represents 20% of the payment volume that keeps accumulating and delaying what accounts payable departments can do. And if it's a sole business owner, that's a nightmare because that's what they end up doing in their nighttime hours. So what we rapidly got to understand is not every invoice needs to go to accounts payable. That's the beauty of people having cards and lodging them right with merchants. The problem they had was as a business, actually the timing of that charge is really key to my business. And in the old days, when you used to lodge a card with these merchants, well, they'd ship the goods and then they'd charge your card. Well, there was no ability for you to quality check the goods. There's no ability for you to check. Actually, if you said you're going to send 100, you'd send 100. And so one of the big things that came back was, look, I'm fine lodging a card with all these different suppliers, but A, I need it to be its individual card per supplier so that we know exactly what's happening. But B, I want that card to have precisely available credit of zero until I decide it is time for it to be paid. And then essentially I inject a value to that card that says, okay, I'm now ready for you to go and charge that card. So timing is key because a lot of these companies are saying, well, no, I want to wait until I've got enough purchases that I get the best possible discount with that merchant. I want to wait until I know that I've had the right cash inflows so that essentially from a working capital perspective, it's going to clear at the time at which that particular charge is presented, and eventually the statement comes and they have to pay it off. So timing is also a hugely critical thing for businesses, and one that's often overlooked is being able to manage the timing of payments, specifically during this particular transition period, right? They have to have that capability. So that's one key element, right? We talked a little bit about reconciliation, where effectively there's two things really happening and you have to marry them back together, right? So that's the law firm trying to essentially recoup expenses. It is essentially the same thing with the trucking companies, right? Reconciliation is key, and that's all linked to enriched data. And so ultimately what we have to be able to produce is enriched data that can then be pushed into whatever platform the client's using. If they're using Concur, we can inject it in there. If they're using Expensify, we can inject there. If they're using QuickBooks, we also throw the data there and then have it essentially organized so that essentially not only does it all reconcile, but it actually ledgers correctly. So I benefit from that automation on the back end. We've talked a lot about not just control over timing, right, but controls over when, over what period of time, as well are key elements, the types of merchants that you can spend at. We talked about those as benefits. And then there's an underlying huge benefit in all of this, which is, you know, for every dollar that's spent, and again, it's a bit of a phenomenon in the US that's somewhat been diluted internationally, is the whole concept of earning rewards or cashback. It's a ginormous industry here in the US, right? You earn up to 2% cashback, sometimes more, right, as a company, if you're a really big company.
I've worked with people who would spend 3 days figuring out which airline to fly with just for the point. It always amazed me, but you're right. It just happens.
It's, look, the American dream to some extent here is if I travel as a business person, can I accumulate enough charges on cards, whatever they are, my business cards, my this, my that, so that essentially my family can go on a vacation. They'll pay for my flights, they'll pay for my hotel, they'll pay for my car rental. And all in all, by all my hard work that I've delivered over the course of the year means that we go off on a family vacation. And so rewards are a really powerful tool. I will say that they're definitely bigger here, but obviously having worked at American Express, I saw, like, the world over just how much companies were earning in terms of cashback and how important that was to these companies, right, in terms of the benefits they got from these card programs.
Yeah. Staying on the subject of customer case studies, would you be able to describe your ideal customer? Who do you find that is the sweet spot for your solution?
I think it's all about timing. At the moment, we'd say our target customer is small, mid-sized businesses, because they're typically the business owners who can make instant decisions. There isn't a hierarchy of decisions they have to go through in order to start using the product and the capabilities. And because we've activated on the back of the very card you have in your pocket, we've now actually made this product available to their middle market segment. So it's a net new thing come to market for all these smaller businesses. But over time, look, we're talking to some of the biggest clients out there. We know that in the same way that as a credit card is useful to a consumer as it is to someone who works in one of the biggest, you know, Fortune 100 companies, it's just that the sophistication and the time it takes them to sign contracts and start engaging and rolling out because of change management and all these different things, it's just hurdles that have to be gotten through to get there. But I'd say in the immediate timeline, because we're unconstrained in that middle market segment, that's obviously a real, real sweet spot. And we know then over time, as we continue to grow, not just into international markets, but actually across bank client segments, we know that we'll also then get into the consumer segment, where there's just as many needs in the consumer world of kids going to college, aging parents living overseas, whatever it is, right? The ability for you to arm those individuals for different use cases is just as key. You know, why should you have to pay expensive wire transfers when, frankly, they could use your card, and not better still, right? You get to benefit from the rewards points of them using that card, and you've not paid for all these transfer fees. So we see a huge benefit coming to the consumer world. And then over time, we also see benefit at the top end of enterprise, which is the government. Because same thing there. It's that whole body has a number of different needs for them to also be empowered for people out in the field doing different things. You go into higher ed and other areas like teachers who have a stipend and today use their own cards, right? Tomorrow, teachers would have a stipend that's on essentially a school-funded account, again, where you can go and buy on Amazon because you have to buy school supplies and all these different things. So again, we see it spreading. but by virtue of the types of businesses we're engaged in, right, it's just going to take a different amount of time for it to reach those different segments.
I think politicians should be forced to use virtual cards for transparency. So I reckon that would be a huge market.
Well, it's funny. We thought about campaigns. We thought a lot about campaigns during the election here. But essentially, we were a little bit, we were coming to market right around the same time as the elections were really coming about. But I suspect in the next few years, these campaigns will be driven right through these kind of tools that really drive transparency.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last few questions around the solution is, I think the first one's self-explanatory in terms of setup time. I'd imagine it's a few hours to a day max. It seems quite simple to set up.
So actually with American Express, it is five to 10 minutes. You pull out the card in your pocket, you register it inside of an Extend application. American Express sends you an email to say, did you mean to do this? Can you please log into your American Express site and confirm that's what you wanted to do? A very necessary security measure. And then since you've said yes, it activates your account. And at that point, you can start sending virtual cards. So let's say all told 15 minutes before you're sending out your first 10 virtual cards.
Excellent. No IT people needed almost, I'd imagine. Like, unlike the GE example you gave earlier, I'd imagine it's pretty straightforward.
Look, that was a key part of us thinking about bringing a business. We knew that if we had to go to a bank and say, well, you could use this platform, but you have to do these 17 things, we'd be like, we'd be number 300 on the list. So we knew whatever we did, we had to use the technology that they already had at their disposal, and that essentially that we could get access to on their behalf. So that was the first thing we had to be sure of. The second thing we had to be sure of was precisely that the clients themselves wouldn't then have to do any technology integration, because that's again, they have limited resources. So that's partly why we launched all of these user experiences. We know over time, the experiences that we've built will be embedded inside of the different banking apps. But we're in a place where there are very few business banking apps. There's consumer banking apps where you can put your corporate card in it, but it's really got consumer level features and functions. What we're rapidly realizing in the industry as a whole, that there has to be other functions for businesses because they just need to have more things happening in their ecosystem in terms of employees and tracking these different things. And so we're at the forefront of that. But over time, we fully expect to be injecting our capabilities, right, into these apps that the banks will launch.
What's your pricing structure for somebody that wants to use this platform?
So we negotiate directly with the issuers. So we make money of when dollars essentially are spent through on the platform. And then essentially, right, that's how we price. We don't charge the present end customers. We don't charge the fintechs either that essentially we're helping with this buy now, pay later concepts, right? It's a revenue share, right? We only earn if they earn. And that's the key is it's really truly a mutual benefit there of if there's usage, they get the benefit and we get the benefit. But our fees come from the banks directly as well.
That's a great model. I love it. Okay, so we're pretty much done with the main part of the show. That was really, really insightful. So thank you.
Pleasure.
I'd like to finish with talking about the future. So I personally can't stand plastic cards. So here's a question. When do you predict they'll finally die? And would be good to know your thoughts in general about crypto and what you think is happening in that space. I personally think the whole financial wiring of the world is being burnt to the ground by crypto and it's going to be rebuilt. But some people disagree. So I'd love to know your thoughts around that too.
So look, when is plastic going to go away? The simple answer is it's going to go away as soon as you have ubiquity of acceptance with merchants around the world. Because the long pole will ultimately be the country, the place that hasn't gone to a full digital stack. And until you're there, right, there's no good reason why you would eliminate plastic. It's expensive. It's not ecologically friendly by the time you ship out cards left, right, and center. So I think everyone's pretty happy at the prospect. What you had, though, was banks and consumers really wanting to run towards digital. But digital, unfortunately, meant that we were putting a burden of cost on the merchants. They had to upgrade their terminals. They had to pay monies for it. And for them, it's a bit like, what am I getting additionally for spending this additional cash? And the answer was, you know what? It's a little bit of the example you said with American Express. People always know you have another card in your pocket. And so you know, if they didn't accept, they knew that you'd pull out a physical card. So there was no real impetus for them to make that change. Now, that has changed here in the US, and it had already started changing in other parts of the world. And I think now people are able to see a future where plastic is no longer needed, where it's more secure, right? Why should you even share the 15 or 16 digit number on your piece of plastic? Why should anyone even see it? The reality is they shouldn't. There's no need to do it. If it's securely lodged in your phone, then there's no reason for that to happen, right? And so then you'll get to less data breaches, especially as you start thinking about, rather than your actual card number, you're using the Apple tokens and all these things, right? It's so encrypted that it becomes really hard to try and break through those security barriers, because the card on file that's lodged against your purchase ain't really the actual account, right? That essentially you have your monies served against. So look, my best guess is we're somewhere between 5 and 10 years before plastic disappears. But again, they're going to have to deal with the long pole in the tent, right? And that's going to depend on, you know, the different countries around the world where people do travel, want to travel. And so that's going to be the limiting factor.
And what do you think about crypto and that so kind on of the, world?
Yeah, on the crypto side, I think the world is changing. I think there's been a tremendous excitement about it, but it's been at such a massive macro level that actually the reality is, like, when you come to then bring it down to the actual business, there's a long way still to go to say, this is how you would use this technology in the context of what's already there. And as I mentioned to you before, right, the existing payment stack is not going away anytime soon. And for me, the reason for that is simple, is it has to tie back to the cause of these banks, right? It's how do they underwrite? They have a certain set of systems for that. How do they essentially then manage risk and fraud? And they have systems for that. Then they have ledgering systems that issue your statements, and then remittance systems that take in your payments, right? And then a whole customer service set of portals. That's a big ecosystem, right? And it's taken a long time for it to work the way it does. And so the whole concept of burn it down and start again, it's just not realistic. And I think what's really happening, and this is where I get excited by, you know, technologies like crypto and other things, it's really about abstracting. If you think about what we're doing, is we're saying, you know what, those systems are there to stay. In the same way, SAP is there to stay. Is it going to be the user experience that you and I interact with in the business over time? No, because it's just not a great user experience. It's not adapted to the business that I'm in. It's a generic platform that you then essentially can use for your business, but it's not designed for it. And so in the same way that Concur abstracted expense management away from SAP, Ariba abstracted procurement away from SAP, and then there's a myriad of other systems and platforms. The concept of the core is the core because it's the ledger. It's a great data source for reporting, for management insights, et cetera, et cetera. That bit gets to stay. But then the question is, how can you abstract slowly but surely all these different pieces, right? It's a Trojan horse that comes in over the top and slowly eats away at the different components. And I think that's how technologies like crypto and other things will come into, and more specifically blockchain and other things will come in and start to replace those systems. And again, you have to remember that in financial services, we're dealing with money. And when we're dealing with money, by definition, people are going to want to see that there's regulation, because through regulation, they get assurances that their money is safe. And so those are some of the things that will always have to be taken into account, because, you know what, if it's money, I want to make sure it's there tomorrow morning and it just didn't suddenly disappear overnight.
Hashtag Wirecard.
Hashtag Wirecard.
There you go. Actually, I find it, to your point and against my point, one of the most popular types of crypto are stablecoins, ironically.
That's right. Because essentially people can understand the mechanics right behind them. And I think that's the thing. People know the sure value of cash, right? Yes, you can get devaluated and whatever else as a currency. But as it relates to your particular experience in that country, right, over the short period of time, you have a pretty good understanding of what it's doing. You don't want it to be an asset that is traded, right? You just want it to be a stable coin, right, that you can rely on.
Yeah. And it fits into your abstraction thing perfectly. That's the advantage of it, is people who can't get US dollars easily can now get them, and especially for doing global trade.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Awesome. So that brings us to the end. We'll move on to a couple of rapid fire fun questions in a sec. But in terms of, if anyone listening wants to get in touch and is interested in your solution, it's paywithextend.com. And Twitter is @paywithextend. Do you guys do demos and webinars and things like that?
Yeah, so we do demos and we're doing more and more webinars through different partners that we operate with. And again, very happy to have inbounds right across any of those channels. And obviously people can reach out to me directly as well.
Excellent. Okay, so I'll pick two from my fun question section. What have you been reading this past 6 or 12 months? Anything that you enjoyed particularly?
So I would say my wife would laugh out loud at that question. She's like, reading? What are you talking about? It's like, it's been 5 years since I've seen you read a book. So I read the FT, right? That's my version of reading at the moment. But then again, you know, I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. And actually we've been prioritizing the great outdoors at the moment. So for me, it's been more about getting the sanity and tranquility by going back to nature. And then just keeping up to date with everything that's going on, right? An ever-increasing rate, which is why I read a lot around the newspapers. And you know, I'm reading a lot of trade things. As a founder of a startup, right, you're inherently paranoid about things that are happening around you, right? Because things move really fast. And so you just need to have your finger on the pulse. So I haven't, I'd say I'd prioritize of my passion free time. A lot of it's gone more towards doing sports, and running around as much as I possibly can, given the lockdowns that we've had.
Yeah, great stuff. And largest purchase you've regretted? Final question.
A car. So I haven't had a car since I want to say 2004.
That's exactly the same as me. That's the last time I had a car.
So I gave it up first for a scooter because when I was working for Amex in London, it was a really easy scooter ride to work and it was consistently 15 minutes and I didn't have to worry about, you know, the tube that kept on falling over every 2 minutes on the Circle Line. So I got fed up with that. So I got a scooter and I loved it. And surprisingly, it doesn't rain a lot during commuting hours, I discovered in London. I was like, it rains all the other times, but actually I was amazed. In the mornings, no, it was actually pretty good. Then in terms of why it's the biggest regret is, we finally, on the back of this pandemic, realized that, you know, in order to access the great outdoors, and somebody lives in downtown Manhattan in the West Village, we actually needed a car, partly because I didn't want to be taking Ubers, right? Especially at the height of the pandemic in March, April, May of last year. So we started renting a car. Anyway, I decided to go and purchase a car, and I put that purchase in October, and here we are in April, in March, sorry, and the car still hasn't arrived. It's not due to arrive till June, right? So.
No.
I suspect and I hope, I sincerely hope, that by the time we get to June, most people have had their immunizations, right? And so we go back to normal. And I'll probably sit there going, why do I now own a car? Because I'm happy to go back to using Ubers and traveling around. But anyway, that's the story there. That's what happens when you try and buy a car. And I should have just bought one off the lot rather than trying to buy, you know, after not having had a car for so long, I wanted to get the exact thing I wanted. And by the way, it wasn't something super fancy. Right?
Right.
It was a Kia Telluride. And it's like, it's just unfortunately become a car that a lot of people want to buy and they've run out of parts because of the pandemic and all these different things. So that's my long answer to it's a car.
Well, we'll see lots of RVs on the market maybe when everything's back to normal because they all sold out very quickly, apparently.
They did. Bicycles, RVs, tents.
Oh, yeah. Bikes. Yeah.
As well, right? We did a lot of camping. Everything that you could do outdoors suddenly became, right, there was a huge premium on it.
I did watch a funny YouTube video that all the preppers in the States were just telling everybody, I told you so, and hanging out in their garages with their, you know, dried foods and ammunition. It was quite funny to see those videos.
Yeah, it's funny / very scary.
Yeah.
So yes, that's some of the things we deal with.
Excellent. Well, that was really a great episode, Andrew. It was really fun having you on. You're welcome back at any time in the future if you want to give the listeners an update.
I appreciate that. It was lovely to chat to you and again, really happy to get the message out to the audience. So thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, no problem. And good luck to you and your team in the future. You've got big plans, so I wish you all the best of success.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, there are a few things you can do which I would really appreciate. Please take a moment to leave a review on iTunes, which will help other people to discover the show more easily. And secondly, please share this episode with anyone you know who would find it useful. Thanks for listening and see you in the next episode.